Ready.
User in your channel timed out.
Everyone's cool with me starting?
Yeah, sure.
Ezekiel 44. Then he brought me back the way of the gate of the outward sanctuary, which looks toward the east, and it was shut. Then said Yahweh unto me, This gate shall be shut, it shall not be opened, and no man shall enter in by it, because Yahweh, the God of Israel, has entered in by it. Therefore it shall be shut.
User entered your channel.
It is for the prince. The prince, he shall sit in it to eat bread before Yahweh. He shall enter by the way of the porch of that gate, and shall go out by the way of the same. Then brought he me the way of the north gate before the house. And I looked, and behold, the glory of Yahweh filled the house of Yahweh, and I fell upon my face. And Yahweh said unto me, Son of man, mark well, and behold with your eyes, and hear with your ears, all that I say unto you concerning all the ordinances of the house of Yahweh, and all the laws thereof, and mark well the entering in of the house, with every going forth of the sanctuary. And ye shall say to the rebellious, even to the house of Israel, Thus says Yahweh God, O you house of Israel, let it suffice you of all your abominations, in that you have brought into my sanctuary strangers, uncircumcised in heart and uncircumcised in flesh, to be in my sanctuary, to pollute it, even my house. When you offer my bread, the fat and the blood, and they have broken my covenant.
Microphone muted.
Because of all your abominations. And you have not kept the charge of my holy things, but you have set keepers of my charge in my sanctuary for yourselves. Thus says Yahweh God, No stranger, uncircumcised in heart, nor uncircumcised in flesh, shall enter into my sanctuary, of any stranger that is among the children of Israel. And the Levites that are gone away far from me, when Israel went astray, which went astray away from me after their idols, they even shall bear their iniquity. Yet they shall be ministers in my sanctuary, having charge at the gates of the house, and ministering to the house. They shall slay the burnt offering. I missed my spot. I usually read from my actual Bible, but I don't have it on me, so I'm reading online.
I'm sorry, I wasn't following along closely enough. I know you got through, like, verse 8. But...
Yeah. Do you just want me to stop, or?
Yeah. I want to look at this word "stranger" in Hebrew, because Strong's just has been. Sometimes Strong's is kind of faulty.
I'm going to go get my actual physical Bible.
Microphone activated. Beckar.
It's the son of a stranger, the son of a Nekar.
And Nekar is that a racial one or a non-racial stranger?
No, Nekar sometimes has non-racial connotations, and I've actually elucidated that in a podcast I did some time ago. I don't remember which one. However, in this context, the son of a Nekar, it would indicate a non-Israelite in this context.
Well, a lot of this, I think, could be cross-reference to Malachi chapter 2, because you've got strangers, you know, working in the temple, and then it speaks of the covenant. And how the covenant is now null and void because you've got strangers offering sacrifice. That's a lot like Malachi with the priest, the priests that have committed a sin with that is like the sin that Judah committed when he took a strange wife. So they were at the time of Malachi, they were inviting strangers into the temple, and that they were making sacrifices that Yahweh did not accept.
Right. Here were at least 100 years and maybe as many as 200 years before Malachi, though. It's hard to tell when Malachi wrote, but it was definitely after the time of Haggai and Zechariah. Because Haggai and Zechariah speak about the building of the temple, but in Malachi, the temple's already built.
Yeah, it's a thing of the past. I can't find the verses in Malachi, but there's one that says something like, "Was not my covenant with Levi?" And then here in Ezekiel, you've got...
Yeah, that's in Malachi chapter 2.
"Uncircumcised in flesh, to be in my sanctuary, to pollute it. When ye offer the blood, the fat and the blood, they have broken my covenant." So that's a lot like that.
Yes, I would agree.
Should I continue?
Why not?
Ezekiel 44, verse 11. "Yet they shall be ministers in my sanctuary, having charge at the gates of the house. And ministering to the house, they shall slay the burnt offering and the sacrifice for the people, and they shall stand before them to minister unto them. Because they ministered unto them before their idols, and caused the house of Israel to fall into iniquity. Therefore have I lifted up my hand against them, says Yahweh God, and they shall bear their iniquity. And they shall not come near unto me to do the office of a priest unto me, nor to come near to any of my holy things in the most holy place, but they shall bear their shame and their abominations which they have committed. But I will make them keepers of the charge of the house, for all the service thereof, and for all that shall be done therein. But the priests, the Levites, the sons of Zadok, that kept the charge of my sanctuary, when the children of Israel went astray from me, they shall come near to me to minister unto me, and they shall stand before me to offer unto me the fat and the blood, says Yahweh God. They shall enter into my sanctuary, and they shall come near to my table to minister unto me, and they shall keep my charge. And it shall come to pass that when they enter in at the gates of the inner court, they shall be clothed with linen garments, and no wool shall come upon them while they minister in the gates of the inner court and within. And they shall have linen bonnets upon their head, and shall have linen breeches upon their loins. They shall not gird themselves with anything that causes sweat. And when they go forth into the utter court, even into the utter court to the people, they shall put off their garments wherein they ministered, and lay them in the holy chambers. And they shall put on other garments, and they shall not sanctify the people with their garments. Neither shall they shave their heads, nor suffer their locks to grow long. They shall only poll their heads. Neither shall any priest drink wine when they enter into the inner court. Neither shall they take for their wives a widow, nor her that is put away. But they shall take maidens of the seed of the house of Israel, or a widow that had a priest before. And they shall teach my people the difference between the holy and profane, and cause them to discern between the unclean and the clean." Should I stop here?
That's fine.
Well, there you have it.
That's fine.
The priests are failing to discern between the clean and the unclean. I've got all these strangers in the temple.
Right. They have all these strangers in the temple that didn't belong there. That's recounting their past sins, the sins that they committed in Jerusalem. At this point, there is no temple. There is no temple here. It's recounting the sins that they committed in Jerusalem, which has already been destroyed about 6 or 7 chapters ago. maybe a little more than that. And this is the theoretical temple.
Microphone activated.
By which the children of Israel are to be ashamed. So by recounting how it should be, they should be ashamed that they didn't do it that way when they had the temple in Jerusalem. That's how I'm reading this. We're going to see that word for strangers again, but the word isn't the same word. It's not Ben Nakar, which is the son of a stranger. As we get to verse 22, it's going to be...
User.
No, I'm sorry. That's not until chapter 47. So the strangers aren't mentioned again here in this context. I'm wrong.
User,
I glanced at it and thought it was here. But this is now speaking the way it should be instead of the way it was. Basically, I think in order to embarrass the priest, just as the children of Israel were shamed, the priest should be shamed.
Now, verse 22, it even says, they shall take maidens of the seed of the house of Israel. You know, I know there's a lot of, you know, losers who say, oh, there's nothing racial in the Bible. But I mean, how much more plain can you get? Take maidens of the seed of the house of Israel. And then in Malachi chapter 2, you know, I know that's much later, but we find that they weren't taking wives of their own people and that was their sin. That was Judah's sin. So this is reminding me of that again. Because it explicitly says, they shall take maidens of the seed of the house of Israel. That's racial for sure.
Well.
And then the very next verse, and they shall teach my people the difference between the holy and profane and the unclean and the clean. So you want to take a clean wife. He's saying, this is what a clean wife is, a maiden of the seed of the house of Israel. No more uncleanness. So what's uncleanness? These unclean people that can't be clean. Profane can be clean. But unclean, you can't do anything about that. You can't put a pig on the altar and try and clean it.
Right. That's absolutely true. And that's a good observation. That is a direct connection between verses 22 and 23. The Levitical priests were required to marry virgins in the law, but the rest of the people were not, but the Levitical priests were required explicitly to marry virgins. And so they must have diverged from that law. They must have been violating that law towards the end of the First Temple period in order for it to be an issue here. Because of the context of these commands, of these explanations and these admonishments, we have to imagine that these are the things they were doing wrong at the end of the First Temple period when Judah was punished and went into captivity. And now they're being shamed and they're being shown this plan for a new temple so that they would be shamed. But they never built that new temple. They were challenged to, but they never did it. They weren't commanded to, but they were challenged that if they would repent, that this is the way it could be. And they never did it.
I think this would have shamed them at the time. Like it's saying, this is how things were supposed to be. And they would have been like, oh, you know, now we're living, we've been cast out of our land. We never lived up to that. They can see, like, they would have known we never lived up to that. This is what it's like when the people cried when they heard the law.
Right. Yeah, that's what it is. That's what's going on here.
Yeah, I can imagine them crying. Definitely ashamed.
This difference between a holy and a profane It's repeated in Ezekiel earlier in chapter 34. As for you, O my flock, thus saith Yahweh God, behold, I judge between cattle and cattle, between the rams and he-goats. And then a little further on, therefore I will save my flock, and they shall no more be a prey, and I will judge between cattle and cattle, and I will set up one shepherd over them, and he shall feed them. To judge between cattle and cattle, I think, it is to judge between the sheep and the goats, between those who belong and those who don't. That was in Ezekiel chapter 34. So now it's like the same admonition is being given in a different way. Because they still don't, after all this time, understand the difference between the holy and the profane. And they still don't, even after another 2,700 years.
Yeah, in Malachi, they didn't get it either. They tried to reason against God and say, well, wasn't Esau Jacob's brother?
Right. And that was the absorption of the Edomites. But I think Malachi was prophesying that rather than recording it.
Shall I continue?
Sure.
Verse 24. And in controversy, they shall stand in judgment, and they shall judge it according to my judgments. And they shall keep my laws and my statutes in all mine assemblies, and they shall hallow my Sabbaths. And they shall come at no dead person to defile themselves, but for mother or for mother, but for father or for mother, or for son or for daughter, for brother or for sister that has had no husband, they may defile themselves. And after he is cleansed, they shall reckon unto him 7 days. And in the day that he goes into the sanctuary, unto the inner court, to minister in the sanctuary, he shall offer his sin offering, says Yahweh God. And it shall be unto them for an inheritance. I am their inheritance. And ye shall give them no possession in Israel. I am their possession. They shall eat the meat offering, and the sin offering, and the trespass offering, and every dedicated thing in Israel shall be theirs, and the first of all the first fruits in all things, and every oblation of all, of every sort of your oblations, shall be the priests. Ye shall give unto the priest the first of your dough, that he may cause the blessing to rest in your house. The priest shall not eat of anything that is dead of itself, or torn, whether it be fowl or beast. End of chapter 44.
I think that law is a general law in Deuteronomy that we shouldn't eat anything that is dead of itself or torn, whether it be fowl or beast. That even though the priests are being held to that law specifically here, I'm pretty sure that law carries over for everybody in Deuteronomy. I don't know if anybody's going to remember that offhand. Yeah. I doubt it, but
it does. We can look it up if you like, but I remember that.
I don't really know if it's that important. But basically, the priests have they don't have flocks. The Levites didn't have flocks. They didn't have land. They relied on the tithes of the other 11 tribes in order to survive. And that's basically what we see here. I mean, if you weren't getting enough in tithes, you had to go be a vulture, right? I would imagine you had to go pick up roadkill to survive.
The real priest probably went off and did real work, and then a bunch of Jews came in and started scamming because they were prepared to act like vultures.
Right. I agree with that. That there's a place, I don't remember where it is. It's somewhere in scripture where the real priests weren't around to teach, and it was probably because they had to go off and do real work. It really was.
Yeah, I remember that. They each one has left to his land or something like that. It's a verse that says something like that. I can probably find it.
But if you're a priest and you have the land, what do you, how do you survive? If you have to rely on other men to hire you, and you have to basically be slaves to them in order to make your living. So you're no longer employed by Yahweh, by God. Now you're, if you're not hunting for roadkill, you're a slave to somebody who may be a heathen. Whoever would hire you for a higher wage.
All right, well, chapter 45 then, or?
Yeah, sure. Well, did you have something to say, Bill?
Yeah, in a nutshell, they're being warned not to be searching for roadkill here. That's what they're being warned.
Roadkill would be torn.
So, yeah, roadkill would be something torn or died of itself, right? There were no automobiles to run over deer in those days.
So if you hit a deer with a car, you can't eat it, but if you shoot it with a bullet, you can.
Right.
All right.
Yeah, you know, 2 years ago here, I hit a deer with my car on the road, with my truck on the road, and Melissa and I went by the spot, and the next morning, that deer was gone. Somebody snatched it up and ate it.
Sorry, yeah. I should.
It was gone, and that's the case with every deer that gets hit here. Some redneck sees it and pulls over and grabs that thing up and takes it home and puts it in his freezer. But I couldn't do that. I couldn't do that because the law tells you not to.
It's no good for you anyway, depending on how long it's been sitting there.
Even though I just hit it, I wouldn't do it.
It's got to be gutted pretty soon, otherwise it's no good to eat.
Right.
So I don't know what that guy, I guess he probably thought, oh, it's still pretty warm. But, you know, it's hard to tell because they'll stay warm for like a few hours, especially in Florida. That doesn't mean that it's good.
No, we're not supposed to eat stuff like that.
Yeah, for a reason. It's just not good for your health. I mean, you know, the blood starts getting all congealed or whatever the hell that word is.
Congealed.
Yeah.
Congealed, right.
Conjugulated, maybe. I don't know what that word means. I just know it's a word.
Yeah, it just gets hard and problems start.
Coagulated.
That's it. What did I say?
Well, the coagulators do like form a clot.
It's congealed, I think.
But congeal is when fat or blood, it is warm and liquid, and then it, as it cools, it begins to solidify. And fat and blood can both congeal. But we don't really need the biology lesson. We can move on to 45.
Ezekiel 45. Moreover, when you shall divide by lot the land for inheritance, you shall offer an oblation unto Yahweh. A holy portion of the land, the length shall be the length of 25,000 reeds, and the breadth shall be 10,000. This shall be holy, and all the borders thereof round about. Of this there shall be for the sanctuary 500 in length, with 500 in breadth, square round about, and 50 cubits round about for the suburbs thereof. And of this measure shall you measure the length of 25,000 and the breadth of 10,000. And in it shall be the sanctuary and the most holy place. The holy portion of the land shall be for the priests, the ministers of the sanctuary, which shall come near to minister unto Yahweh, and it shall be a place for their houses, and a holy place for the sanctuary. And the 25,000 of length, and the 10,000 of breadth, shall also the Levites, the ministers of the house, have for themselves, for a possession for 20 chambers. And you shall appoint the possession of the city 5,000 broad, and 25,000 long, over against the oblation of the holy portion. It shall be for the whole house of Israel. And the portion shall be for the prince on the one side, and on the other side of the oblation of the holy portion, and of the possession of the city, before the oblation of the holy portion, and before the possession of the city from the west side westward, and from the east side eastward. And the length shall be over against one of the portions, from the west border unto the east border. And the land shall be his possession in Israel. And my princes shall no more oppress my people, and the rest of the land shall they give to the house of Israel according to their tribes. Thus says Yahweh God, let it suffice you, O princes of Israel. Remove violence and spoil, and execute judgment and justice. Take away your exactions from my people, saith Yahweh God. You shall have just balances, and a just ephah, and a just bath. The ephah and the bath shall be of one measure, that the bath may contain the tenth part of a homer, and the ephah the tenth part of a homer, and the measure thereof shall be after the homer. And the shekel shall be 20 gerahs, 20 shekels, 25 shekels, 15 shekels shall be your manna. This is the oblation that you shall offer, the sixth part of an ephah for a homer, of a homer of wheat. And you shall give the sixth part of an ephah of a homer of barley. That's verse 13. I can continue if you want me to.
Well, let me just put this in perspective. I just worked out the numbers real quick. This reed that Ezekiel was using was 6 cubits of a cubit and a hand's breadth, which is a royal cubit, which is about 21 inches. So 25,000 of those reeds, when you take 21 inches and multiply by 6 and divide it by 12, and then take that result and multiply it by 25,000 and divide it by 5,260, you end up with about just about 50 miles in length and about 20 miles, just short of 20 miles broad, being only 10,000 reeds broad. So the land that's being spoken of here is 20 miles by 50 miles is a considerable portion of land. The city's only 10 miles by 50 miles, according to verse 6 here. And this never happened in history. This division never happened in history. So thereby we know that this entire temple vision is basically allegorical. It's an offer that they never were able to take up or fulfill, just to show that they couldn't save themselves, and no action of their own could save them, in my opinion.
Verse 7 speaks of a prince singular. Would that just be the king of Judah?
Yeah, right. The word is not really expected in that context, speaking of the Levites. Is it the high priest being the principal of the tribe of Levi? Would be my guess.
User entered your channel.
We're in Ezekiel 45, and this prince appears in verse 16, verse 22, and in verse 22, we see that the prince is the high priest. And upon that day shall the prince prepare for himself and for all the people of the land a bullock for a sin offering. And then that's corroborated in chapter 46, the burnt offering that the prince shall offer unto Yahweh in the Sabbath day shall be six lambs without blemish, and so forth.
Oh, okay.
So prince here is a reference to the high priest.
I read the CNT a lot, so whenever I read Prince, I usually think of Yahshua.
Right, I understand. And I did that. I translated Kyrios in that manner on purpose. I had several reasons for doing that. I think I explained it in the introduction.
Should I continue?
Why not?
Verse 14, concerning the ordinance of oil, the bath of oil, you shall offer the tenth part of a bath out of the core, which is a homer of 10 baths, for 10 baths are a homer, and one lamb out of the flock, out of 200, out of the fat pastures of Israel, for a meat offering, and for a burnt offering, and for peace offerings, to make reconciliation for them, saith Yahweh God. All the people of the land shall give this oblation for the prince in Israel. And this shall be the prince's part to give burnt offerings and meat offerings and drink offerings in the feast and in the new moons and in the Sabbaths and all solemnities of the house of Israel. He shall prepare the sin offering and the meat offering and the burnt offering and the peace offerings to make reconciliation for the house of Israel. Thus says Yahweh God, in the first month, in the first day of the month, you shall take a young bullock without blemish and cleanse the sanctuary. And the priest shall take of the blood of the sin offering and put it upon the posts of the house and upon the four corners of the settle of the altar and upon the posts of the gate of the inner court. And so thou shalt do the seventh day of the month for everyone that errs, and for him that is simple, so shall ye reconcile the house. In the first month, in the 14th day of the month, you shall have the Passover, a feast of 7 days, unleavened bread shall be eaten. And upon that day shall the prince prepare for himself and for all the people of the land a bullock for a sin offering. In 7 days of the feast, he shall prepare a burnt offering to Yahweh, 7 bullocks and 7 rams, without blemish daily, a 7 days, and a kid of the goats daily for a sin offering. And he shall prepare a meat offering of an ephah for a bullock, and an ephah for a ram, and an hin of oil for an ephah. In the 7th month, in the 15th day of the month, shall he do the like in the feast of the 7 days, according to the sin offering, according to the burnt offering, and according to the meat offering, and according to the oil. End of chapter 45.
That word meat is unfortunate, because it should have probably been translated gifts, because it's obvious in the context that it's not talking literally about meat as flesh. But in 1611, the meat, the word meat really meant just food. It wasn't specific to flesh. In the Hebrew, there is no word for meat at all. It's just a gift, tribute, or offering, an ephah. And that's it. Even though the word bullock, of course. Leads us to believe that it's an animal. That word meat is just unfortunate because it's not always meat. I don't know what else I can say about this chapter. I mean, these things, I'm sure they did attempt to follow the Old Testament rituals and sacrifices of the Second Temple period, but this isn't referring to the Second Temple period. This is referring to a temple that was never really built, because the Second Temple was never built along these lines or organized along these lines. So it seems. I guess we commence with chapter 46, and we have nothing else to say about this chapter. It may or may not be interesting to compare these ordinances to the ordinances of the first temple, something which I haven't done and which I certainly can't do here. But there's certain features that are missing here, like the most notably, the Ark of the Covenant and the mercy seat. There's no mercy seat. There's no sprinkling of blood on a mercy seat in order to symbolize that remission of sin. There was a requirement under the Old Covenant.
Ezekiel 46. Thus saith Yahweh God, the gate of the inner court that looks toward the east shall be shut the 6 working days, but on the Sabbath it shall be opened, and in the day of the new moon it shall be opened. And the prince shall enter by the way of the porch of that gate without, and shall stand by the post of the gate, and the priests shall prepare his burnt offering and his peace offerings. And he shall worship at the threshold of the gate. Then he shall go forth, but the gate shall not be shut until the evening. Likewise, the people of the land shall worship at the door of this gate before Yahweh in the Sabbaths and in the new moons. And the burnt offering that the prince shall offer unto Yahweh in the Sabbath day shall be 6 lambs without blemish and a ram without blemish. And the meat offering shall be an ephah for a ram, and the meat offering for the lambs, as he shall be able to give, and a hin of oil to an ephah. And in the day of the new moon, it shall be a young bullock without blemish, and 6 lambs, and a ram. They shall be without blemish. And he shall prepare a meat offering, an ephah for a bullock, and an ephah for a ram, and for the lambs according as his hand shall attain unto, and a hin of oil to an ephah. And when the prince shall enter, he shall go in by the way of the porch of that gate, and he shall go forth by the way thereof. But when the people of the land shall come before Yahweh in the solemn feast, he that enters in by the way of the north gate, the worship shall go out by the way of the south gate. And he that enters by the way of the south gate shall go forth by the way of the north gate. He shall not return by the way of the gate whereby he came in, but shall go forth over against it. And the prince in the midst of them, when they go in, shall go in, and when they go forth, shall go forth. And in the feasts and in the solemnities, the meat offerings shall be an ephah to a bullock and an ephah to a ram, and to the lambs as he is able to give, and a hin of oil to an ephah. Should I stop there?
It's as good a place as any in a 24-verse chapter. I don't that this an ephah of a bullock and an ephah of a ram, that language is kind of like strange to me, because an ephah is usually a word that's used to measure oil or grain. I think it's actually a dry measure of grain. And it's equivalent to the bath, which is a liquid measure. And that's what Brown Driver Briggs seemed to say here. So an ephah is the same as a bath, but one's a dry measure and one's a liquid measure. And that makes sense. So it's kind of like odd to me that they're measuring an ephah of animal. An ephah of the flesh of these animals, evidently, is kind of strange. I don't know if that's elsewhere, if that is usage is elsewhere in the Old Testament. I don't know, but I don't really recall seeing it. I mean, it might be. It's just kind of strange. An ephah of an animal. An ephah for a ram. So an ephah of what for a ram? Because it's not explicit. An ephah of grain for a ram or something like that? I don't remember seeing anything explicit here. And the meat offering shall be an ephah for a ram. And a meat offering for the lambs, as he shall be able to give, and a hin of oil to an ephah. It's kind of strange language to me, and it doesn't seem like the thought is complete reading the chapter. Is it an ephah of grain in exchange for a ram? Because that word for meat can also refer to grain or any sort of food. It's kind of weird to me. I don't think it's that important. I think what's more important is that this is the schematic for the children of Israel that they never fulfilled and should have been shamed by it. And we don't know if they were ever really shamed or not, right? I mean, Ezekiel was told to present it to them so that they would be shamed.
What about verse 9, how if you come in from the north, you have to exit out the south, and if you come in from the south, you have to exit the north? So yeah. People have to keep going the way they're going. They can't turn around. You know, that might be symbolic.
They have to traverse through the whole temple or city? That's kind of strange, too.
But it seems like it might be symbolic or something, like you can't turn around or... Actually, one of the commentaries, it says they can't turn their backs on God. I don't know, that seems... So they have to go the same way they're going so that they're never turning back. It's symbolic or something, maybe.
It may be. It has to mean something. I mean, it has to have some meaning. Even if we may not understand what it is. If you enter in the south gate, that means you have to exit through the north gate. That means that you have to traverse the entire city, right? You have to cross it once. Doesn't mean you shouldn't turn your back. I mean, I guess that seems like a more valid interpretation. But we can only conjecture.
If you have to traverse the whole city, it's like you have to do the whole thing. And it says in verse 10, and the prince shall be in the midst of them. And when they go in, he shall go in. And when they go forth, he goes forth, I guess. So he's leading them the whole time. And they never turn back. They never turn around. I don't know. It seems symbolic.
Almost seems like they're leading him. Yeah, this is symbolic of something, but I don't know if we could possibly know what, Joe.
Yeah.
Except that when you put your hand to the... What was
yeah,
it?
Yeah, that's a good cross-reference.
Yeah, you shouldn't turn back.
Yeah, plow,
I'm sorry.
Isn't it? Oh, plow, isn't it?
The plow, yeah. When you put your hand to the plow, you can't turn back, right.
That's a good cross-reference, yeah.
Well, what it really means, I don't know if we'll ever know in this life. Someday, 10 years from now, I might do a commentary on Ezekiel and really sit and meditate on it, but I don't know if I'll be able to figure it out.
Yeah, there's no way to be sure, I don't think.
I can think of no allegory or example from the Old Testament that might explain it. Except that the Magi, when they came to see the Christ child, they wanted to get away from Herod, so they left by another route than the route they came in by. In other words, they passed through and didn't go back. That's not really a comparable example, though, I don't think. I guess we can proceed with the chapter.
Ezekiel 46, verse 12. Now when the prince shall prepare a voluntary burnt offering, or peace offerings voluntarily unto Yahweh, one shall then open him the gate that looks toward the east, and he shall prepare his burnt offering and his peace offerings, as he did on the Sabbath day. Then he shall go forth, and after his going forth, one shall shut the gate. Thou shalt daily prepare a burnt offering unto Yahweh of a lamb of the first year without blemish. You shall prepare it every morning, and you shall prepare a meat offering for it every morning, the sixth part of an ephah and the third part of a hin of oil, to temper with the fine flour, a meat offering continually by a perpetual ordinance unto Yahweh. Thus shall they prepare the lamb, and the meat offering, and the oil, every morning, for a continual burnt offering. Thus says Yahweh God, if the prince give a gift unto any of his sons, the inheritance thereof shall be his sons, it shall be their possession by inheritance. But if he give a gift of his inheritance to one of his servants, then it shall be his to the year of liberty. After it shall return to the prince, but his inheritance shall be his sons for them. Moreover, the prince shall not take of the people's inheritance by oppression, to thrust them out of their possession, but he shall give his sons' inheritance out of his own possession, that my people be not scattered, every man from his possession. After he brought me through the entry, which was at the side of the gate, into the holy chambers of the priests, which looked towards the north, and behold, there is a place on the two sides westward. Then said he unto me, this is the place where the priests shall boil the trespass offering and the sin offering, where they shall bake the meat offering, and they shall bear them not out into the utter court to sanctify the people. Then he brought me forth into the utter court, and caused me to pass by the four corners of the court. And behold, in every corner of the court, there was a court. In the four corners of the court, there were courts joined of 40 cubits long and 30 broad. These four corners were of one measure. And there is a row of building, round about in them, round about them four. And it was made with boiling places under the rows round about. Then said he unto me, These are the places of them that boil, where the ministers of the house shall boil the sacrifice of the people. End of Ezekiel chapter 46.
Are you muted, Bill?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I did it. I guess in verse 46, boiling places aren't places that are boiling, but they're places that boiling is done. I thought that was funny when I first read boiling places. I'm like, these places are boiling? No way.
Yeah, I thought it was funny too. I've got courts within courts and within courts. That was a bit weird too. That's a bit of a strange.
Yeah, boiling places. Don't want to go in those places. No, there's places where boiling is done.
Maybe there's saunas.
That would, I don't know. That means that there were, like, in this temple, there are lots of altars in order to boil in so many places. So there was a whole row of, four rows of buildings, it seems like it's saying in verse 23, where there were places that the priest boiled things. And that never happened even in the second temple. There's no mention of that historically anywhere. I don't know if all these minute details concerning what the Levites were supposed to do in a theoretical temple that never happened are important. I mean, I know there's a lesson in them. These are the things that the Levites of the first temple period should have been attending to, and they didn't. But this, what it says here about the land, that if a man gives land to his servant, that it has to return to the sons at the year of Jubilee, which is the year of release, or the year of liberty, as it is here. That's the year of the Jubilee, when in the 50th year, every 50th year, all property had to be returned to its original owners, to the family that owned that inheritance. So you couldn't give real property away permanently to a stranger. It had to stay within your family line and pass on to your sons or their sons. But I imagine after sufficient generations, like 10, 20 generations, even the biggest estates would become split into so many pieces among sons that nobody could actually live off of them. That's what I would think. I don't know if y'all have any thoughts on that, but that's about all I can say about this chapter.
No, that's interesting that after so many generations, there'd be too many sons to inherit much at all. I guess that's inflation.
I mean, think about it. If you have two brothers and your father leaves you 300 acres, you each get 100 acres. But if you have four sons, each of them get 25 acres.
But if each
of them has on average four sons, then that 25 acres has to be split among 16 grandsons. So they all get like an acre and a piece. Acre and three quarters or something like that.
What about if it only went to the eldest and then his eldest, and there was always one guy?
Then the other sons have no inheritance at all?
I'm just asking, like, is it possible?
I mean, the eldest is supposed to have a double portion, technically. So if Joe had four sons, his land would have to be split into five pieces, and the eldest would get 40%, and the other three would each get 20%.
It would still whittle down.
Yeah, rather quick. So if the nation doesn't expand, then there are always going to be problems. I don't know. To me, that's simple math. I don't know what they did in practice. But the eldest son doesn't get all the land. He only gets a double portion.
What they did in practice is they invited even more people to come into the land and share their land.
Yeah, right.
All the strangers.
And Latinos, squat monsters, chains.
And they imagined that would make things better somehow.
Yeah, I agree. There's nothing new under the sun. They were doing it then and we're doing it now.
You know what, though? If it, like, I'm not saying that this was accurate, but if it did only go to the eldest, for example, you would still need to have a need for more land because those other guys would have nothing and they'd have to go out and find some. So you'd still have to expand.
Right.
Either way, there's no solution. I mean,
no.
Maybe it's Yahweh's design so we would have like a compulsion to blossom and bud and fill the face of the world with fruit.
And one of Joseph's sons has like the biggest family and they're the ones that are pushing, his horns are pushing, you know, the horns, there's a verse about it, you know, the horns of Joseph pushing the Israelites
to the land. I think it's Deuteronomy chapter 32. It's not the blessings of, well, there's a similar blessing, I think. It might be in Genesis, right? I'm going to look. Genesis 49. Oh, no horns of Joseph. I'll have to look at this another way. Oh. Well, I imagine I know how it was, but how it was worded, but now I don't have it because I can't find it that way. I'll find it one way or another. Okay. We remember it, and I sort of remember that from British Israel books or something, the horns of Joseph. But it's in Deuteronomy chapter 33, which made me close. I was thinking about the Song of Moses. It's in 33. In the song, it begins in 32, right? Well, his glory is like the firstling of his bullock, and his horns are like the horns of unicorns, and with them he shall push the people together to the ends of the earth, and they are the tens of thousands of Ephraim and the thousands of Manasseh. So Joseph is a subject, but it's just not really worded the way you said it, Joe, but the way you said it is repeated often. I know it is, and I probably repeated it myself. The horns of Joseph will push his people to the ends of the earth. That's repeated very often, but it's not quite stated that way. It's Deuteronomy chapter 33, verses 16 and 17.
Yeah, it's funny how we pick up things and then repeat them.
Right, but it's really just a summary of what it says rather than verbatim. So I'm searching Bible work for Joseph horns, Joseph earth, and I ain't coming up with it.
Same.
Until I searched for Ephraim. I searched for Ephraim in horns and found it. So there you have it. We can probably finish these last two chapters. I mean, 47 isn't very long, and 28. is actually a little longer, but we can do it if y'all want. I mean, there's not a whole lot for me to say about what we just read in 46 even. It's just details about this Levitical priesthood and what it would be doing in a theoretical temple. But what it does is it illustrates their failures. It illustrates a lot of their failures in the first temple. It really does. So we have failures in the line of inheritance in the first temple, where strangers were getting inheritances and not returning them in the year of liberty or the year of the jubilee. So this is stating that if a stranger gets an inheritance, he will return it in the year of the jubilee. So that must have been for that to be mentioned here, to me, that must have been a fault in the first temple period, that they really weren't keeping the law the way they should have. So property was falling into the hands of strangers. Rather than going to the sons.
I mean, would you regard those unrighteous servants that Christ spoke about, like they don't have to be racial Israelites, do they? Those servants who killed the heir, like they say, oh, look, the true heir's coming. Let's kill him and seize the inheritance. They don't have to be racial Israelites, do they? So some of these servants may not be Israelites too.
Well, the proof that they weren't racial Israelites is in the fact that they weren't sons. They were husbandmen. That they were leasing out the farm. They were only leasing the estate so that they could work the estate. That they weren't sons. So being leasors or tenants, they wanted to kill the heir so that they could keep it to themselves. Because if you kill the heir, then who has a claim on it? You keep it to yourself. Who's to say anything? There were no property tax records in those days.
Yeah, a servant might feel that the jubilee is getting close. Oh, we're going to have to kill the heir. We don't want to lose our nation. And you know what? I think actually Edomites are actually considered servants of God in a sense, because they're the vessels of destruction, because everything in Jacob's loins belongs to God. So God has a right to use the Edomites as he sees fit. They're kind of like they're not true servants of God, but they're sort of servants in a way.
Well, right. Absolutely. And that would be everything in Isaac's loins.
Oh, so yeah, I always do that. Thanks, Bill.
So yeah, they would be servants of God, just like tyrannical governments are servants of God in Romans chapter 13, that do his will by punishing sinners. Even if they themselves are fucked up, that they're a scourge in the hand of God. So it is with Edomites. They're a scourge in the hand of God. And niggers. So they're serving God, but that doesn't mean that they're going to have a good end. Rather, God is just using them.
Yeah, and in Joel 2:25, he says, I will send the locust, the cankerworm caterpillar, my great army, which I sent among you.
Yeah, that's what he called it, my great army. You're right. A great army of chinks, Arabs, spicks, and niggers.
Well, great meaning large, and they are, population-wise.
The key to the bottomless pit, he has it.
Yep.
Well, I'm up for continuing. If we finish 47 and 48, it'll give us a good entrance for Daniel next week.
We should do Susanna, though, shouldn't we? I mean, we're...
Yeah, we should really do Susanna as a preface to Daniel. I agree.
Yeah, I agree, too. Okay, Ezekiel 47. Afterward, he brought me again unto the door of the house, and behold, waters issued out from under the threshold of the house eastward. For the forefront of the house stood toward the east, and the waters came down from the right side of the house, at the south side of the altar. Then brought he me out of the way of the gate northward, and led me about the way without unto the utter gate, by the way that looks eastward. And behold, there ran out waters on the right side. And when the man that had the line in his hand went forth eastward, he measured 1,000 cubits. And he brought me through the waters. The waters were to the ankles. Again, he measured 1,000 and brought me through the waters. The waters were to the knees. Again, he measured 1,000 and brought me through. The waters were to the loins. Afterward, he measured 1,000, and it was a river that I could not pass over, for the waters were risen, waters to swim in, a river that could not be passed over. And he said unto me, Son of man, have you seen this? Then he brought me and caused me to return to the brink of the river. Now when I had returned, behold, at the bank of the river were very many trees on the one side and on the other. Then said he unto me, These waters issue out toward the east country, and go down into the desert, and go into the sea, which, being brought forth into the sea, the waters shall be healed. And it shall come to pass that everything that lives, which moves, whithersoever the rivers shall come, shall live. And there shall be a very great multitude of fish, because these waters shall come thither, for they shall be healed, and everything shall live where the river comes. And it shall come to pass that the fishers shall stand upon it from Enjadi even unto the Enejalim. They shall be a place to spread forth nets. Their fish shall be according to their kinds, as the fish of the great sea, exceedingly many. But the miry places thereof and the marshes thereof shall not be healed. They shall be given to salt. And by the river upon the bank thereof on this side and on that side shall grow all trees for a meat, whose leaf shall not fade, neither shall the fruit thereof be consumed. It shall bring forth new fruit according to his months, because their waters they issued out of the sanctuary. And the fruit thereof shall be for meat, and the leaf thereof for medicine. End of verse 12.
Well, these places are very specific places, right? And I can't identify this with anything in history, of course, because I believe this is all theoretical. I think that's why I can't. But En Gedi is a place on the Dead Sea. It's that Fount of the Kid. A fount of the kid could be spring or whatever, a well, unto Eneglaim, fount of the two calves. They're actually very similar names. An angle would be fount of the calf, and an Anglaim would be fount of two calves, or it's a dual or plural. So, they're very specific names, and even though the sites aren't really certain, as Strong's admits, of En Eglaim, it seems that they reference specific places, that this can't just be juxtaposed to anywhere, right? You see what I mean? It can't be transferred anywhere else.
Well, if those places aren't healed, what are they? Are they places where bastard races live or the Arabs live or something? I don't know, because you've got this desert that will be healed, you know, so it's a waste that's going to be healed, and then you've got this other place that's not going to be healed.
Right.
Is this some sort of New Testament reference, or like Christ, the living waters, or...
Well, this land would be in the very south of Judah, but it being by the Dead Sea, it would be in the south of Judah. And yeah, that it bordered on the lands of Edom, right? And we learned from Ezekiel chapter 34 that the Edomites were already moving into the south of Judah in Ezekiel 34 and 35.
At verse 10, it says, and their fish shall be according to their kinds, as the fish of a great sea. So according to their kinds. That racial? No, mean. What's mean?
A mean, it is a part or a portion. So yeah, that could be racial, because if you're speaking about people in general, and you say according to their portion, you're talking about one branch of people or a particular race of people. That mean is only a word that means a fraction or a portion of something. So when you pull that this definition in this new Strong's Concordance thing in Bible Works, It says a kind, sometimes a species, usually of animals. Yeah, right. They don't want to say it's people. Groups of living organisms belonging in the same created kind. Yeah, I agree with that. It's a mean, it's a portion. Their kind means your portion or their portion of us, the general race, which in this instance is fish. So yeah, where you say fish shall be according to their mean or their portions, well, that means you're going to put all the trout over here and all the bass over there and all the carp over there and all the catfish, which are unclean, over there. So you're going to portion them out according to their kinds, according to their portions. You're going to divide them according to their portions. Yeah, that's a racial statement. That's the parable of the net.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like. It sounds like some sort of division anyways, where the living and the dead, and there's, and it by geography and by kind is what, I don't know exactly what it's saying, but that's sort of what it seems to be saying to me at this point. Like, there's a division by geography and by kind. And then you've got at verse 12, the leaves for healing. That reminds me of something in Revelation, the healing, the leaves for the healing of the nations. But I don't know what to make of all this. It's pretty
it's esoteric. A little bit obscure. It really is esoteric. He's at the forefront of the house toward the east, which in Jerusalem points really to the River Jordan, not quite far south enough to be the Dead Sea, I don't think. I mean, I'm going to look it up real quick on Google Maps, because my memory is never perfect. Jerusalem, Google Maps. But I think only the Jordan is east of Jerusalem. Jerusalem is at the very top of the Dead Sea, right? It's right even with the top of the Dead Sea. In latitude, if you look at Google Maps. But this is saying that waters came down from under the right side of the house at the south side of the altar, which is kind of strange. That doesn't describe Jerusalem. waters didn't fall out of Jerusalem. There was no rivers running out of Jerusalem into the sea. Then he brought me out of the way to gate northward and led me about the way unto the other gate by the way that looked eastward. And behold, there ran out waters on the right side. Looking north, eastward would be the right side. And when the man had the line in his hand and went forth eastward, he measured 1,000 cubits and brought me through the waters. The waters were to the ankles, so they really weren't deep waters. Again, he measured 1,000, that's 1,000 cubits, and brought me through the waters, and the waters were to the knees. 1,000 cubits, royal cubits, I would say, is roughly like a half a mile. A little less. Again, he measured 1,000, and he brought me through the waters, and the waters were to the loins, so they got deeper. The 3,000 cubits are deeper. Afterward, he measured 1,000, and it was a river that I could not pass over, for the waters were risen, waters to swim in, a river that could not be passed over. So that's like 4,000 cubits. That this is not describing any real geographical feature. This is just allegorical. Even though these are specific places that are a little later in a chapter, that there's specific places, it's just allegorical. And the water gets deeper and deeper as you go out.
What's hilarious is that you got the Jews on the western walls knocking their heads against the wall trying to get in by the back door.
At the bank of the river, there were very many trees on one side and on the other. That this kind of seems almost like the city of God in Revelation chapter 22, the way it's described, but that then again, it's not quite the city of God because they're separating different kinds of fish. So we're not quite there.
Yeah, so fish that live in the Dead Sea will live, and fish that live in the marshes will die. I don't
know. Yeah, right. That sounds crazy.
Yeah, I know. I was just joking. It's hard for me to make sense of this because the desert. What does it come into the East Country? Maybe I'm trying to force an interpretation on it.
Right, I know. I mean, a lot of these prophecies, we see the correct interpretation very clearly, and others are very obscure. And perhaps we're missing some sort of context or some sort of information that would give us context, some sort of idiom or allegory that would give us context. The miry places thereof and the marshes thereof shall not be healed, they shall be given to salt. So only the fish in the deep waters shall live. Evidently. Neither shall the fruit thereof be consumed. And by the verse 12, and by the river upon the bank thereof, on this side and on that shall grow all trees for meat, whose leaf shall not fade, neither shall the fruit thereof be consumed. It shall bring forth new fruit according to his months. Now there are generally 12 months, and the tree of life in the Revelation, which is on the river in the city of God, has 12 manners of fruit.
It also says the leaf won't fade.
12 tribes, but there were 12 months. I'm sorry, David.
Oh, it was me. I was just thinking how it says that the leaf shall not fade, which makes me think of eternal life for those trees.
Right, I agree. In the city of God, the trees, the leaves on the tree are for the healing of the nations. Which could point to the element of eternal life as well. So there might be something here, Joe, in like maybe an apparition of the vision of the city of God given to John. I would have to study it at a much deeper level to determine that. And it might be a dead end. But it seems like there are a lot of correlations. And Joseph gets two portions. Joseph received a double portion in place of Reuben. We can continue, I guess.
Yeah, sure. All right, verse 13. Thus saith Yahweh God, this shall be the border, whereby ye shall inherit the land according to the 12 tribes of Israel. Joseph shall have two portions, and ye shall inherit it, one as well as another, concerning which I lifted up my hand to give it unto your fathers, and this land shall fall unto you for inheritance. And this shall be the border of the land toward the north side from the great sea, the way of Hethlon, as men go to Sedad, Hamath, Berotha, Seborim, which is between the border of Damascus and the border of Hamath, Hazar Hadakon, which is by the coast of Haran, and the border from the sea shall be Hazaranan, the border of Damascus, and the north northward, and the border of Hamath, and this is the north side. And the east side, you shall measure from Haran, and from Damascus, and from Gilead, and from the land of Israel by Jordan, from the border unto the east sea, and this is the east side. And the south side, southward, from Tamar, even to the waters of strife in Kadesh, the river to the great sea, and this is the south side southward. The west side also shall be the great sea from the border, till a man come over against Hamath. This is the west side. So shall you divide this land unto you according to the tribes of Israel. And it shall come to pass that you shall divide it by lot for an inheritance unto you, and to the strangers that sojourn among you, which shall beget children among you, and they shall be unto you as born in the country among the children of Israel. They shall have inheritance with you among the tribes of Israel. And it shall come to pass that in what tribe the stranger sojourns, there shall you give him his inheritance, says Yahweh God. End of chapter 47.
It's sort of interesting that there are no specific measurements given here. There are some measurements given in 48 as we proceed, but they're not given for every tribe. It's kind of weird. That's okay. We'll read it briefly. We'll read it in a short time. I don't know if I really have anything more to say about this passage.
22.
But there are no specific measurements given here.
This time, stranger is Ger in 22, by the way. Post in Akash.
Yeah, that's something that I was preparing on explaining in chapter 44, and now it's with my mind. That stranger, yeah, it's not Nekar, it's Ger. And a Ger is a sojourner or a someone with an expectation of hospitality by treaty or custom is what a Ger is. It's the Xenos. It's the equivalent to the word Xenos in Greek. It's funny that that's turned around on us in modern language into xenophobia, which is a lie, because not all aliens are worthy of that label of Xenos or Ger. A Ger is a sojourner. It's somebody that you don't mind seeing in your land, that you expect to see in your land. It has an entitlement of hospitality by treaty or custom. So it's not an invader or an infiltrator.
I guess I'm a Ger in the U.S. I hope.
Yeah, you are. You would be considered a gayer in Florida. But these Haitians and Jamaicans and Cubans and Puerto Ricans and other assorted squat monsters, they shouldn't be considered gayer. They should be considered Nicar or just strangers. It's unfortunate. It's a dumbing down of our language that several different Greek words and at least four different Hebrew words are all translated as stranger in English. It really is a dumbing down of language and concepts. I guess we could read chapter 48. Maybe I don't have anything much more to say about 47. All the place names are all quite precise, though. I will say that. And it starts at the north side at Hamath, which was far north of the borders of Israel. Hamath was the extent of David's kingdom. It was in northern Syria. And the children of Israel held Hamath for a long time until they lost it to the Assyrians, and then Jeroboam II took it back. And it was lost again when the Assyrians invaded Israel itself and destroyed Samaria. But Hamath was far north of Samaria and Jerusalem. So we see that in this idealized theoretical temple period, which never happened, the children of Israel would occupy a much greater portion of Palestine than what's known as Old Testament Israel historically. And these things will be mentioned again in Ezekiel 48 as we close.
All right, Ezekiel 48. Now these are the names of the tribes, from the north end to the coast of the way of Hethlon, as one goes to Hamath, Hazaranan, the border of Damascus northward, to the coast of Hamath, for these are his signs east and west, a portion for Dan. And by the border of Dan, from the east side unto the west side, a portion for Asher. And by the border of Asher, from the east side, even unto the west side, a portion for Naphtali. And by the border of Naphtali, from the east side, unto the west side, a portion for Manasseh. And by the border of Manasseh, from the east side, unto the west side, a portion for Ephraim. And by the border of Ephraim, from the east side, even unto the west side, a portion for Reuben. And by the border of Reuben, from the east side, unto the west side, a portion for Judah. And by the border of Judah, from the east side, unto the west side, shall be the offering, which you shall offer of 25,000 reeds in breadth, and in length, as one of the other parts, from the east side, unto the west side, and the sanctuary shall be in the midst of it. The oblation that you shall offer unto Yahweh shall be of 25,000 in length, and of 10,000 in breadth. And for them, even for the priests, shall be this holy oblation. Toward the north, 25,000 in length, and toward the west, 10,000 in breadth, and toward the east, 10,000 in breadth, and toward the south, 25,000 in length. And the sanctuary of Yahweh shall be in the midst thereof. It shall be for the priests that are sanctified of the sons of Zadok, which have kept my charge, which went not astray when the children of Israel went astray, as the Levites went astray. And this oblation of the land that is offered shall be unto them a thing most holy by the border of the Levites. And over against the border of the priests, the Levites shall have 25,000 in length and 10,000 in breadth. All the length shall be 25,000 and the breadth 10,000. And they shall not sell of it, neither exchange, nor alienate the first fruits of the land, for it is holy unto Yahweh. And the 5,000 that are left in the breadth over against the 25,000 shall be a profane place for the city, for dwelling, and for suburbs, and the city shall be in the midst thereof. End of verse 15.
Yeah, literally, it sounds exotic in Nehemiah. It's not really that clear, but it's evident that some of them must have been among the priests that had later screwed up because they were there with Nehemiah from the beginning. So some of the sons of Zadok must have failed in the period of Ezra and Nehemiah with the other priests that were committing fornication and going after strange flesh or race mixing. It seems that the 20 and 5,000 here and the 10,000, that they're references to the same reed, and that translates into roughly 50 miles by 20 miles, that 25,000 by 10,000 in breadth. And of course, this land was never divided historically in this way. It just wasn't. So this is still in the theoretical or allegorical temple that was never built, because the children of Israel never took the initiative upon themselves to follow through with what Ezekiel had told them. They were shamed. This was for their shame, as we learned from Ezekiel chapter 43. I don't know if there's anything that else that needs to be discussed in light of that.
Yeah, I can continue. All right, verse 16. And these shall be the measures thereof: the north side 4,500, and the south side 4,500, and on the east side 4,500, and the west side 4,500. And the suburbs of the city shall be toward the north 250, and toward the south 250, and toward the east 250, and toward the west 250. And the residue in length over against the oblation of the holy portion shall be 10,000 eastward and 10,000 westward. And this shall be over against the oblation of the holy portion, and the increase thereof shall be for food unto them that serve the city. And they that serve the city shall serve it out of all the tribes of Israel. All the oblation shall be 25,000 by 25,000. You shall offer the holy oblation four square with the possession of the city. And the residue shall be for the prince on the one side and on the other of the holy oblation and of the possession of the city, over against the 25,000 of the oblation toward the east border, and westward over against the 25,000 toward the west border, over against the portions for the prince. And it shall be the holy oblation, and the sanctuary of the house shall be in the midst thereof. Moreover, from the possession of the Levites, and from the possession of the city, being in the midst of that which is the prince's, between the border of Judah and the border of Benjamin, shall be for the prince. As for the rest of the tribes, from the east side unto the west side, Benjamin shall have a portion. And by the border of Benjamin, from the east side unto the west side, Simeon shall have a portion. and by the border of Simeon, from the east side unto the west side, Issachar, a portion. And by the border of Issachar, from the east side unto the west side, Zebulun, a portion. And by the border of Zebulun, from the east side unto the west side, Gad, a portion. And by the border of Gad, at the south side, southward, the border shall be even from Tamar, unto the waters of strife in Kadesh, and to the river toward the great sea. This is the land which you shall divide by lot unto the tribes of Israel for inheritance, and these are their portions, saith Yahweh God. And these are the goings out of the city on the north side, 4,500 measures. And the gates of the city shall be after the names of the tribes of Israel, 3 gates northward, 1 gate of Reuben, 1 gate of Judah, 1 gate of Levi, and at the east side, 4,500, and 3 gates, and 1 gate of Joseph, 1 gate of Benjamin, 1 gate of Dan, and at the south side, 4,500 measures, and 3 gates, 1 gate of Simeon, 1 gate of Issachar, 1 gate of Zebulun. At the west side, 4,500, with their 3 gates, 1 gate of Gad, 1 gate of Asher, 1 gate of Naphtali. It was round about 18,000 measures, and the name of the city from that day shall be called Yahweh is there. The end of the book of Ezekiel.
Well, in Revelation chapter 22, there won't be any animal offerings, burnt offerings, sin offerings. We're past all those points in our history. And of course, Christ is the only propitiation for sin. But this is still very, it evokes the, it strongly evokes the image of the city of God in Revelation chapters 21 and 22. Even in the enumeration of the tribes and their gates, where in the Old Testament tabernacle in the wilderness, Joseph was divided in two. And of course, Ephraim and Manasseh and Benjamin were in the same camp. But Levi was in the center and didn't have its own quarters, so to speak. This is divided more like the gates of the city in Revelation, where Joseph only has one gate, even though he has a double portion, and Levi has his own gate, right? So the 12 tribes of Israel, the gates have the names of the 12 tribes of Israel. So it's almost evocative of the tabernacle in the wilderness, but not it's not quite because of that specific feature. It's more like the city of God in Revelation. And this might in some ways be a premonition of the city of God, but it's not quite there, because in the city of God, there'll be no need for burnt offerings, whole offerings of animal sacrifices, for any sin offering or anything like that. So it has its differences that this is very, very much more like the Old Testament Levitical practices rather than the New Testament in Christ, whereas it has some features of the city of God in the New Testament rather than the Old Testament tabernacle in the wilderness or the Old Testament temple. So in that way, it seems to be transitory. It seems to be represent a transition. But as I keep saying here, this whole temple and these practices of the Levites were all allegorical to show them their shortcomings and to shame them for their transgression of the old covenant. This land was never apportioned in this manner. It was never built in this manner for that reason. And it's interesting because I estimate those 25,000 reeds to be just about 50 miles. So I measured the distance by sea at the level of Jerusalem from the coast, which is actually where the site of ancient Ashdod, from the coast of the Mediterranean in a straight line through Jerusalem and to the northwest corner of the Dead Sea, is 51 miles of our miles. So it's really close to these 25,000 reeds. I thought that was kind of interesting.
I feel like the fact that the city is called Yahweh is there also evokes imagery from Revelation, the fact that Yahshua is our king and walking among us.
Yes, it does. And it evokes Ezekiel, the closing verses of Ezekiel chapter 37, which have a prophecy that Yahweh will put his tabernacle among his people Israel, which that tabernacle is Yahshua Christ. So it evokes that as well.
User disconnected from your channel.
And that's the end of Ezekiel. I don't know if I have anything more to say that's relevant or that's important or significant. I probably don't. I don't know if I said anything significant all night, but Ezekiel, those last chapters are what they are. They're all hypothetical.
User disconnected from your channel.
They never happened. They weren't meant to happen. They were only supposed to be an illustration to shame the children of Israel.
It's sort of beautiful, though, if you think about it, because it never happened. We failed, but like, it has the same ending as Revelation. So we get there in the end anyways. But only through the mercy of God.
That's a very good observation. But only Christ is going to get us there.
Yeah, exactly. Christ saves us and he gets us there in the end.
So yeah, that's an appropriate observation. That's pretty good.